Please be aware that this podcast is a Star Wars free zone. I repeat, a Star Wars free zone. No discussion of Star Wars or Star Wars movies will occur during this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 77, the first one of 2016. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, as usual, there are two movies. The first one is the 2012 movie John Carter, starring Taylor Kitsch. And then we go on to a Richard Linklater movie from 2006 based on a Philip K. Dick novel, and that is A Scanner Darkly. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey, how's everybody going? 2016. Yes, we've made it this far. Good on all of us. And welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast number
77.
Yep, 77th episode. We survived New Year's Eve. We survived Christmas and New Year's Eve and Newtonmas and all the rest of it quite successfully. Very nice New Year's Eve party. So thank you to Paul and Trudy for that. And I got to catch up with a lot of people, including a couple of our Patreon subscribers. Well, at least one. And, it was very laid back and cool. There was food, there was good company, there was good conversation, and it was all life-affirming and reassuring and just exactly what I want from a New Year's Eve party. It would have been nicer if it was closer to home, but I can't be churlish about this. I'd had a very good time, very good hosts, and very good friends all around. So there we go. And Sal had a terrific time too. It was an extremely hot night. But nonetheless, there were plenty of liquids to drink, of course. And so we survived that successfully. Then yesterday, we went over and had dinner with Sal's father, who turned 70. So happy birthday to Peter. Yes, you survived. Even though you had a near-fatal heart attack when you were 45, you managed to get to 70 so far. So good on Peter. So we gave him presents and went out to dinner. Had the best beef cheeks. If you ever get a chance to eat beef cheeks and you're not a vegetarian, go for it. Had some beef cheeks with polenta chips and a salad. It was beautiful. But let's talk about movies. What have I been watching? I've started a new Letterboxd list for 2016. The 2015 list is closed. And I think there are about 412 or something like that movies watched last year. So this year I decided I want to try to kind of see some more interesting films. I started out last year watching Dumb and Dumber 2, but so I wanted to change that because every time I opened the list to add to it, I didn't want to see a movie like Dumb and Dumber 2 right at the top of the list. So here's what I've watched. Apart from the two movies that I'm going to talk about in the podcast, I started out with a couple of real favourites of mine, which are two Jacques Demy musicals from the 1960s, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort. So I rewatched them. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg always makes me cry. There are very few movies that do that, but The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is one of those films. Catherine Deneuve's in it. It's just a movie that you've got to kind of experience cold and enjoy. It's up there in my top three date movies, right along with Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones. And it is just magical. And then, of course, Young Girls of Roachwood isn't as sad and thoughtful as The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It was made a couple of years later. It has Gene Kelly in it, apart from anything else. It has Catherine Deneuve and her sister Francois Dauriac in it. And it's Demi reinventing. Both of them are kind of Jacques Demi reinventing the movie musical. He was in love with American movie musicals, and he just decided to do something different with them. And I think he succeeded very well. Both of the movies were restored in the last 15 years or so by Jacques Demi's widow, Agnès Varda. And she really did a fantastic job. She got people together. The original films were in Eastman colour, so the colour values faded, and colour was very important to these films. And so Agnès Varda restored them to pristine condition. And anytime you get a print of these films, you know, a DVD or a Blu-ray or whatever, you're going to get a beautifully crisp and colourful movie. And I enjoyed them a lot. The only other thing I've seen is a fairly recent Bill Murray movie that I wanted to catch up with called St. Vincent. It's kind of, you know, him playing a curmudgeonly retired guy who, you know, screams at people. He's an alcoholic. He has a regular assignation with a low-rent Russian prostitute played by Naomi Watts. It's also got Melissa McCarthy in it and a few other people. It's got a small child actor whose name I can't pronounce. And yeah, it's pretty good. It's Bill Murray doing some really interesting work there. It's nothing really original and new. It's the kind of redemption of a curmudgeon while still letting him maintain his curmudgeonliness. It isn't like A Christmas Carol or like Scrooge, even, in that there's a total redemption. There's just kind of a opening up of a man whose life situation is incredibly difficult at the start of the film. And that's a slow reveal. I'm not going to do any spoilers on what that involves, but there's a slow reveal on his history and his life. And it's worth checking out if you're that way inclined. It's definitely worth checking out. Murray is very good in the film, playing not against type, but playing an interesting variation on the type. And I did enjoy that. I watched that today, in fact. So that's about it. I've only done five movies this year so far. We're in the 3rd of January, so I'm slacking off compared to a lot of other years, but you know, I've been doing other things as well. So I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies. I think I'll go with John Carter, the Disney adaptation of the Edgar Rice Burroughs novel from over 100 years ago, which Disney were hoping to turn into an adventure science fantasy franchise, but things didn't quite go to plan.
Your kisses take me to Shangri-La. Each kiss is magic that makes my little world a Shangri-La. A land of bluebirds and fountains and nothing to do but cling to an angel that looks like you. And when you hold me, how warm you are. Be mine, my darling. Spend your life with me in Shangri-La. A land of bluebirds and fountains and nothing to do but cling to an angel that looks like you.
That was Wayne Newton with Shangri-La, and that bongo player was really earning his money. Okay, let's get on to John Carter. According to IMDb, this movie was in development for longer than any film in history. 79 years. Originally, Bob Clampett, the animator, was looking to do an animated version of John Carter in the 1930s. And the movie franchise, well, the property, has been in development off and on ever since. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. I just thought I'd throw in that little bit of information. But basically, the story is based on the first of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars novels, which was written back in 1912. It was originally in a magazine, but later on it was novelized, and there were a whole bunch of other novels in the series afterwards. So Disney, who made this film and had the rights to it, decided that they wanted to create a franchise. The movie, the novels were great at their time. It's the story of a Civil War veteran, John Carter, who, through mystical means, ends up on the planet Mars, which has got beautiful princesses, castles, weird technology, six-limbed, 10-foot-tall Martians, crazy, super-intelligent beings, giant, blind, white apes, and all sorts of other interesting things like that. The series went on for a long time. I actually read them when I was young. And they were a lot of fun. They were kind of science fantasy things. And, yeah, they were very entertaining. So, obviously, by the same author who did Tarzan. So, they're pure adventure stories. And a lot of fun for that. And Disney, rather sillily, decided that they wanted to do a franchise. So, they do a big tentpole movie. Get in a director who knew special effects pretty well, and they chose a guy called Andrew Stanton, who directed things like Wall-E and Finding Nemo in animation. This was his first live-action feature. And they gave him almost carte blanche to go out there, spend the money, and make John Carter of Mars, as it was called then. But Andrew Stanton, for reasons nobody knows, decided to just call the movie John Carter, which is a bit like calling it Bob Smith. It doesn't really tell you anything about the film. It doesn't tell you that it's set on Mars and it's a science fantasy and it's over the top and there are princesses and sword fights and weird aliens and gladiator battles and all that sort of thing. The title John Carter is really a fizzer where if you're going to run a franchise, you've got to kind of have something spectacular as a title, and for odd reasons, that didn't happen. There's actually a book out about the making of John Carter to show how early the buzz started to be negative about this film. The social media hit it. There were rumours coming out that Andrew Stanton was overwhelmed by the task, which is understandable. It's his first time directing a live-action feature, and he's making a $230 million movie. It's even for a more experienced director, it can be overwhelming. But for somebody who was used to working in animation, this was more than he could bear in some ways. Now, this isn't to say the movie isn't entertaining, because in a lot of ways it is. The Tharks, a giant 10-foot-tall, four-armed Martians, look really good. They got mocap of people like Willem Dafoe playing one of them, and Thomas Hayden Church, and a number of other actors. So the aliens look right, and the special effects are fantastic. The evocation of ancient Mars with crumbling ruins and vast deserts and weird plants and enormous mountains and all that kind of stuff, it really works well. The scenery and the world created, the world creation in this and the world building is fantastically good. That's something you haven't seen before. There are lots of beautiful aerial shots of Carter/Burroughs Mars, which look right for the books and are really spectacularly, wonderfully evocative. And there's a lot to like in this film. There's also a lot to wish was better. Now, there were a lot of people who were very, very negative about the film, but I wasn't particularly negative about it. I could see the flaws in it, but I could see what was trying to be done as well. But before I talk about that, I'm going to play the trailer now just to give you a feel for it in case, for some reason, you're not hip to this movie.
Mr. Burroughs, I'm afraid I bring sad tidings.
Your uncle's passing came as a shock to all of us.
Where am world is dying. Fate has brought you here, John Carter.
A man holds the key.
You may be the only one who can save us.
It was a sign that something new can come into this world.
That trailer is part of the problem, because what they should have evoked was the wonder and the swashbuckling grooviness of Mars and the adventure and the romance and all of those things that we like in those kind of wild adventure films. They really needed to kind of enhance that. But in a sense, they took the property way too seriously. They should have loosened the belt a little bit and just had some fun with it, but that wasn't to be. Now, the cast isn't bad. For the most part, we've got Taylor Kitsch starring as John Carter. I've got problems with him as John Carter. I think that to be a swashbuckling hero, you need to have presence and you need to have a kind of insouciant gravitas, and he doesn't have that. Then, at playing one of the, probably the focal character in a lot of ways, you've got Lynn Collins playing Deja Thoris, the Princess of Mars, and she's not bad in it. She's got a lot more going than Kitsch has as John Carter, but still you need that kind of, she's not given the opportunity to inhabit the character. There's something inhibiting them. I don't know whether it's the scale of the thing, I don't know whether it was the on-set feeling, but there's something lacking there. But hero and the heroine aren't the most interesting characters in the piece, and that's a big problem. You've got Tars Tarkas, the giant 10-foot-tall green Martian, played by Willem Dafoe. He's a lot of fun in there. You've got the villain of the piece, played by Mark Strong, who brings that kind of English actor menace and gravitas to the whole thing. He's quite good. You've got in the piece before John Carter arrives on Mars, you've got Bryan Cranston playing a military officer out in the west of the 1880s, who basically arrests and tries to get John Carter to help them deal with the Indians. Now, this is another one of the problems with the movie. There are two frame stories around this film. The first one is the one you heard in the trailer, where Edgar Rice Burroughs, who in the conceit of this movie is the nephew of John Carter, arrives and finds out that his uncle has died and that he's the inheritor of the estate, which is quite substantial. And he reads the journals of John Carter, and that's where the story starts. So that's one frame, and that has a payoff at the end of the film as well. The second frame then becomes John Carter before he goes to Mars, and how he's looking for a lost gold mine. He's heard that there's a giant spider carving which will lead him to an ancient gold mine. He's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from both being on the losing side of the Civil War and the fact that his wife and child were killed in an Indian raid. So you've got all of that baggage there. So you've got two frame stories before you even get to the stuff that people want to see, which is John Carter on Mars jumping around like a kangaroo. And in fact, he jumps around more like the Incredible Hulk. The leaps that John Carter does, because he's supposed to be from Earth and he's supposed to have stronger and denser muscles and bones, are superhuman. They're more Marvel than they are marvelous. And that kind of takes away from the film in a lot of ways. It's just unbelievable that a person from Earth can leap in all the ways that John Carter does. just because he goes to Mars, where the gravity is one-third of Earth's. It's not like it's a hundredth of Earth's. It's one-third of Earth's. So while he could leap around pretty substantially, he wouldn't be able to do anything near the stuff that the character does in this film, which Bruce Banner would have trouble doing, as, you know, I'm referencing the previous podcast there. But having said that, the film suffers from things that aren't necessarily the property's fault in some ways. And the biggest one was when Robert Zemeckis was offered this film to direct. And he got to the core of the problem with the film quite early. And when he said to the people who made the offer to the studio, he said, "We can't do this property as a film. George Lucas has stolen all of the good stuff from it." And that's the truth, and that is the problem with John Carter. The fact that all of the groovy Martian stuff and all of the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff and all of the alien desert planet stuff was stolen for Star Wars. That becomes the biggest sticking point for this particular property. All of the really good stuff, which is really good. The things that Burroughs came up with for his alien world are pretty damn groovy, but they've been stolen by a number of people over the years. George Lucas is only one of them. There have been any number of other things. And the original franchise is influential on things like Frank Herbert's Dune. There's a little bit of Burroughs' Mars in the desert planet Arrakis, and the intrigue and the politics of Dune parallels in some ways. And Frank Herbert did a marvellous job. I'm not trying to take that away from him. But he was inspired by this property in some ways, and he had said that himself. There are any number of books and novels and television shows and other things like that that basically stripped over the corpse of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars books. And so by the time that the technology had advanced enough in movie making to do justice to the original works, there was nothing left original of them, which in a half-assed, backhanded way is a compliment to Edgar Rice Burroughs' original kind of vision of Mars. But on the other hand, we're in the 21st century. We're in the second decade of the 21st century. And a movie studio comes along and wants to make this movie, and they're blind to any of those facts. They're blind to the fact that this kind of machine and this world has been stripped bare. People have come in and just taken everything except the skeleton and used it for other purposes and for their own means. That's one of the problems. I think one of the things with big studios like Disney, and of course they've now got Marvel and Lucasfilm on board, and they own both of those, that they were hungry at this time around 2011-2012 to get a really powerful franchise going, and they were willing to look at a number of different directions. Now, Disney's not going broke anytime soon, but this movie did lose money. They were kind of hungry enough to go to want a franchise that they could wholly own, and this is just before they purchased Lucasfilm and just before they purchased all of Marvel. And they were going along with this one, which was incredibly badly considered. Now, this property, and this may have worked a lot better, this property would have worked really well as a television series, whether a short-run television series or whether a long-run television series. The Mars books of Edgar Rice Burroughs would have worked better as that. The technology is there to do the special effects well in a TV format now, increasingly. And if someone like HBO had taken it on, or even CW or something like that, they could have done something with this property. But the decision was made by Disney to make it a big tentpole film, to make it over the top, to make their Mars really wonderful, which they did. The technology of Mars, the ornithopter kind of aircraft they've got, the cities, the systems of technology they've got using rays, the nanotech-like rays of the nanotech-like technologies of the bad guys. All of this stuff is beautifully evoked and harks back to Andrew Stanton's animation background. There's a lot of wonderful eye candy in this film, not the least of which being Lynn Collins in skimpy costumes, and she is quite attractive in that. But, okay, let's put it this way. If this movie had been brought out in 1977, it would have blown everyone away. If it had come out any time before Star Wars, apart from the technology and the CGI and all of that, this property would have been a winner. But time has moved on, and that kind of scavenging of Edgar Rice Burroughs' intellectual property really made this thing something that was never in any circumstance going to work. And I find that pretty horrible and pretty... I mean, I'm pissed off with the people who stole from Burroughs in some ways, but I understand that that kind of thing is going to happen, particularly when 100 years after the thing was originally written, nobody's found a way to make it work as a film. So the scavengers came in and grabbed what they could of it. Now, the movie... Well, the book is now in public domain, because it's 100 years after it was written. The author's been dead a certain number of years, so it's in the public domain. In 2009, there was a version of the movie made as well called Princess of Mars, starring Antonio Sabato Jr. as John Carter and Tracy Lords, the former adult actor, as Deja Thoris. And I watched that, and in some ways, it's amusing. In a lot of ways, it's very silly, and it's fairly low budget. It was filmed around Bronson Canyon and Bronson Caves, just to give you an idea, and it was made by The Asylum, which gives you more of an idea about the budget and the limitations of this particular film. But nonetheless, when 3 years before your enormous tentpole film comes out, The Asylum, being the low-rent and low-budget studio that it is, came out with a version of the story, you've got to kind of think, okay, do I really want to do this? But nonetheless, they did make it. Now, I re-watched the film a few days ago, and it is amusing. I mean, the action sequences are good. The gladiator battle against the two giant white apes is kind of cool. The scenery, as I said, in the ancient ruins that litter the deserts of Mars works really well. The action sequences are well put together, though that leaping around that John Carter does is something that my suspension of disbelief had a lot of trouble with. But I think that it's probably best viewed as an object lesson to studios and as one of those failures that talks a little more about the industry than some other failures do. The fact that Disney was so hungry for a new franchise at this time, before they actually stopped trying to make one and decided to buy two, that they went with this ill-considered property. And now, it's not that it's a bad property, as I said, it's just that it's been pinched so often that there's nothing left. Which, I mean, I'm a science fiction fan, and I've been a science fiction fan since Jesus was playing Cowboys and Indians. And that pisses me off a little bit. I like original authors and original thinkers to get the credit for things. Stealing things without attribution is wrong to me. Now, there's a difference between the kind of stealing that, say, George Lucas did to make Star Wars, and yes, I'm going to beat George Lucas up a little more, just wear it, and the kind of mashups that somebody like Quentin Tarantino does, because Quentin Tarantino puts together a whole bunch of stuff from a whole bunch of different older films and name checks and evokes the older films and actively encourages people to go out and find them. But he adds something new to it. He adds the ingredients of older product, but make something entirely new with it. Whereas I don't think that same latitude should be given to some of the people who've stolen from Edgar Rice Burroughs to make their own things. Now, one of the other problems with the film, which is a kind of more an overdone virtue than something that's a flaw in it, is that they try to cram so very much into the film. They try to cram the backstory. They have to cram the frame story with Edgar Rice Burroughs as a young man. They have to cram in the backstory of John Carter's life on Earth. They also have to cram in a shit ton of who the different races are on Mars, what the politics is. The Tharks are very much a downtrodden minority on Mars, and are various forms of humans, the two cities, Helium and the walking city of the bad guys, is involved. Then you've got the immortal high-tech magicians with Mark Strong's people. There's a lot to cram into this film and a lot to ask audiences to accept within an adventure format. It's like having too much of a very rich cake. Eventually you're going to go, no, no more, please. Now, it's okay to do that in a novel. A novel will allow you to put in a ton of detail and a ton of history and a ton of backstory and a ton of politics and technology and the species stuff and all that kind of thing. You've got the space to do that. But in a feature film, there's an old adage that the way to make a feature film is to adapt a short story. But if you're making a long-form TV series, that's when you've got the opportunity to make a novel. Game of Thrones and things like that being the obvious examples. But John Carter tries to do it the other way around, and unfortunately it just simply doesn't work. I admire the attempt, and I'm glad that we've got a John Carter movie out there. But I think the weaknesses in the two leads and the director's inexperience, the studio's kind of passion to have a franchise, so much so that they pick something this old and this unworkable to do it with, means that it was front-loaded for failure. And I find that kind of unfortunate. I like the Mars stories of Edgar Rice Burroughs. I like the retro future tech of the world, and I like the characters, and I like the adventure. But this movie just unfortunately doesn't work. I've got a lot of goodwill towards it, while totally understanding the reasons why it failed. It's not a guilty pleasure, but it's not a waste of time to watch this film. But you've got to watch it with an awareness of those flaws to appreciate it. I'm not saying to forgive a bad movie. I don't believe this is a bad movie. I think it's an ill-considered one. I think that there are weaknesses in it. But the things that it does well, it does extraordinarily well. And that, to me, is always a virtue. The kind of world creation and the world building is second to none in recent cinema. And I like that. And it's a big-scale world, too. It's not a kind of microcosm. It's a macrocosm. It's a whole planet that they create. And an interesting one at that. But I've got nothing else to say about John Carter except for the fact that it's a tragedy in a sense, while it should never have been born as a film. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and then we get back. We're going to talk about A Scanner Darkly, a much different science fiction work starring Robert Downey Jr., Keanu Reeves, Woody Harrelson, and Winona Ryder.
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching, it's not human.
Gentlemen, you are about to witness for approximately 61 cents the perfect homemade silencer.
That sure is some silencer.
Drive over to my place, kick back, get some tequila.
They're in my hair, on my skin, they're all over the place.
This is a world getting progressively worse. Can we not agree on that? What's on the dessert menu?
Damage has taken place to the normally dominant left hemisphere, and the right hemisphere is attempting to compensate.
Two hemispheres of my brain are competing?
Yes.
I could be murdered.
How'd I get here?
I tip my hat to any entity that could bring so much integrity to evil.
What
What if they come in through the back door or the bathroom window like that infamous Beatles song?
Just sacrifice someone without them ever knowing it.
What does the scanner see? Into the head? Into the heart? Does it see into me? Clearly? Or darkly?
Just awe-inspiring stuff.
I've got to thank a friend of the podcast, Tim Merrill, for giving me a copy of this film. I've forgotten about it, but he, as Christmas present, he gave me a box of interesting films, and A Scanner Darkly was among them. It's actually a Korean DVD of it that he gave me. And I rewatched the film and thought, yeah, I've got to do this for the podcast. It's an interesting one. It's a Richard Linklater film. It's the second movie he did in a rotoscope format. Now, if you don't know what rotoscoping is, it's something that Max Fleischer invented nearly a century ago, where you film live-action people doing things and then cel-animate the live-action so that it looks like a cartoon, in a sense. And that's the manner in which Richard Linklater made this film. They filmed it with the live actors, Keanu Reeves, Winona Ryder, Robert Downey Jr., Woody Harrelson, and Rory Cochrane in particular. And then to get the fucked up reality of the Philip K. Dick original, it was rotoscope animated. Now, that is an alienating thing for some audiences. It really does take you a little while to get your head around, but I think it's right for the material, and I think it really works for the material. I'm not sure I've mentioned it, but the previous movie that Linklater did in this format was 2001's Waking Life. Now, I haven't seen that, but I'm going to have to watch it now. It was produced by Tommy Pallotta, who also produced Waking Life, and in fact, Tommy Pallotta is the hero of the piece for reasons I'll mention in a little bit. The story is very Dickian, and it's one of the most autobiographical of Philip K. Dick's novels. And let's just see, there's a really good précis here somewhere. I want to kind of get that out for you. Yep, it's in Wikipedia, so all credit to Wikipedia. The plot. The United States has lost the war on drugs. It's set 7 years in the future. Substance D, a powerful and dangerous drug that causes bizarre hallucinations, has swept the country. Approximately 20% of the total population are addicted to Substance D. In response, the government has developed an invasive high-tech surveillance system and a network of undercover officers and informants. Bob Arctor is one of these undercover agents. He's assigned to immerse himself in the drug underworld and infiltrate the supply chain. Bob Arctor being played by Keanu Reeves. Now, the problem that Bob has is that due to the secrecy necessary to become an undercover agent, the agents wear what they call scramble suits while they're at work, which are suits they wear, kind of all-encompassing body suits, which make their appearance an ever-changing mosaic of other people's face and bodies. So there's a kind of weird... The animation on this is beautiful, and I don't think it could easily be done as live action. Basically, if you see someone in a scramble suit, their face is constantly morphing from one human being's face to another, male, female, young, old. It doesn't matter. The scramble suits are necessary so that the agent's anonymity is maintained. And while he is working at the drug agency, Bob Arctor's code name is Fred. Now, Fred is told to look into a drug addict and possible drug dealer by the name of Bob Arctor. So he's asked to spy on himself, in a sense. The house is set up with a variety of cameras, and Arctor has to go about his normal day, which is a very abnormal day because he's a drug addict. He's pretending to be a drug addict. and he lives in a house with a couple of other drug addicts, which was originally Bob Arctor's home with his family, and for some reason at some stage in his family had a party in the ways. The two guys living with him are James Barris, played by Robert Downey Jr., and Woody Harrelson playing Ernie Luckman. And they're as fucked up as any drug addicts ever are. Barris thinks he's a genius, and Robert Downey Jr. plays this to the hilt. It's a really nice Robert Downey Jr. role. He's over the top. As you heard in the trailer, he tries to make a silencer out of toilet paper and duct tape. It only enhances the noise of the gun he's using, and not to mention the fact that he's actually trying to put a silencer on a revolver, which never works, because if you're going to put some kind of a suppressor on a pistol, you've got to make sure that it's an automatic. It just doesn't work because of the way the gases explode out of a revolver. It just doesn't work. But he's the kind of fucked up drug addict that just simply doesn't know that and doesn't care. And he, in reality, don't even exchange postcards. And in fact, Robert Downey Jr. steals the movie to a great extent. His Barris is beautifully acted. And of course, Robert Downey Jr. does have a history in his past of various kinds of drug abuse, so he's not acting out of inexperience. He knows this world pretty well, and he knows the kind of drug logic that drug addicts have, and the crazy, off-the-wall and illogical plans they can make to solve problems that are mostly in their own heads. And Downey evokes this really well. It's uncomfortably close to reality, and while it's happening in a rotoscoped animation, it, after a while, drags you into the loose grip on reality that the characters in the movie have. And I find that really cool and interesting. I think that Linklater made the right choice by rotoscoping this one, because it does give us... Well, right at the start, for instance, is probably the best example of this. One of the minor characters in the piece, a guy called Charles Freck, played by Rory Cochrane, is in his house, and he thinks that his body's being attacked by aphids of various kinds, and he's kind of scratching and bathing himself and spraying himself with bug spray and all this sort of thing for these insects that aren't really there. But we see, as he perceives them, as Freck perceives them, so we see him scratching and getting in the shower, and he thinks his dog's infested with him too, so he gets his dog into the shower with him. And we see it from his point of view, and we see all the bugs crawling all over him. If you've got a bug phobia, this is not a movie to watch. But having that scene right at the front of the film actually front loads us with the fact that the rotoscoping is there for a purpose. It's not just there to be smarty pants. It actually works to support the material. Then when we start seeing the scramble suits and those crazily ever-morphing things where the software actually mimics your facial expression. So if you're looking sad and you're looking angry, the software that kind of maps these people's faces onto yours through the suit changes that as well. The animation on this is fantastically good, and it was fantastically difficult to do. Of course, they filmed it all with the actors in the... live, and then of course they had to go and rotoscope the whole lot and animate it. Now the problem with that was that they put together a team to animate it, and it was an enormous failure. The people had to get used to the software, the budgets blew out, the people doing the animation were broken up into teams to do different sequences, and the animation styles were different. There were enormous problems with this. It took 18 months eventually to get everything happening with this film, but the way they did it was they brought in their hero, who was the producer, Tommy Pallotta. And Pallotta tore back everything to scrap and instituted a Disney style of animation to get this post-production rotoscoping happening. He had a style manual, so everybody was animating in the same style. He got it down to a core team of four people. Sometimes they were working 18-hour days to get this animation just right, this rotoscoping and animation just perfectly right. There are a couple of scenes where things appear and disappear from off tables, but with this kind of an endeavor that's inevitably going to happen. But eventually they do get a style that really worked. And that's what we have in the film. It's after a while, you kind of forget the rotoscoping is a part of the film, but you kind of view the film through the rotoscoping rather than bouncing off the surface of it. And I kind of like that as well. As I said, it's one of the more autobiographical of Philip K. Dick's novels, because he was addicted to amphetamines at one stage and kind of went into the drug culture big time. He had a whole bunch of drifters moving through his house. His wife and he had divorced and taken the children with her. And he kind of descended into a drug lifestyle for a time. He was invited at one stage to go to France to give a talk about his writing. And that was probably the thing that, at least for a time, saved him, because he went over there, he cleaned up his act a lot, and kind of broke out of that cycle, and then started writing A Scanner Darkly, because he wanted to talk about his drug addiction and talk about living the life of a drug addict, but in a science fiction environment, because that, of course, the genre in which Philip K. Dick worked. So that the movie actually ends on a somber note as well, because it uses a postscript that's actually part of Philip K. Dick's novel. I'm not going to spoil what that is, but it is quite touching. Now, the problem with Bob Arctor being the kind of agent that he is and the undercover cop that he is that he eventually himself becomes addicted to Substance D, which increasingly causes a schism between the two halves of your brains, and you can't really function as a human being, and there's a lot of cognitive damage done. And, basically it's a very nasty drug in that sense. It's a hallucinogen, but it also affects brain structure in a major way. And there are a few scenes with Bob having batteries of medical tests as a part of his job, where he has to perceive various things on cards, kind of slightly abstracted drawings of things. And again, this is a little like John Carter in a way, because I think that the weakest link in this film is Keanu Reeves. Now, Keanu Reeves is good in a certain kind of movie, but he's never struck me as a particularly adept actor. He's a star, obviously, and he's done a number of things. There are movies of his that I like a lot. I like John Wick. I like a number of other films of his. But he's not the most open and talented of actors. And putting him in a movie with Robert Downey Jr., no way he is not going to act somebody like Keanu Reeves off the screen, and that's what happens here. Even though Bob Arctor is supposed to be the viewpoint character, and we're supposed to sympathise with his problems and the conflict that comes up with the fact that he's supposed to be spying on himself, essentially, and his employers don't know his real identity because all of this secrecy is done at a much higher level, and his supervisors don't know that when they tell him to go and spy on Bob Arctor, that he actually is Bob Arctor. And there's that kind of plausible deniability about it all because of the secrecy. And one of the things that this movie evokes very well is the internal but stupid logic of certain kinds of law enforcement, where they redouble their efforts while forgetting their goals, and they get too involved in the process and not involved in the people, even when they're talking about their own people. When Bob's drug addiction becomes known to them, for instance, they're quite cold and dispassionate about it. They tell him he's going to have a change in his pay packet because there's a fine for becoming a drug addict when you're an undercover agent, and he's going to be heavily fined for this, so his pay is affected as well. There's no sympathy for him as somebody whose collateral damage in this endless, pointless, and unwinnable war on drugs. They're not, they're dealing with symptoms, they're not dealing with the underlying structural problems with society when they're fighting this battle. And I think that that's put well across by a number of the characters in this film. We've got Winona Ryder in there as a fellow drug addict, who's more than she seems to be, and she's quite good in it as well. I think that her and Robert Downey Jr. are the really people who walk away from this best. I think she is very good in it as well, and her, like Robert Downey Jr., her acting comes through quite strongly through that rotoscoping process. Woody Harrelson as well, but I don't think he's kind of trying as hard or has as much to work with in the script. I think his character's underwritten. As much to do in the script as the Robert Downey Jr. character and Winona Ryder's character do. Even though she's ostensibly just there as a kind of, to stop everything being a sausage fest, she's very much important to the story. And she has genuine concern for Bob's plight as well. Her character's name, he said, making sure that I'd name check the character, Donna Hawthorne. She's the only character in there with a functioning moral compass. And as things deteriorate for Bob, she's the one who acts as a voice of reason, even though that voice is not listened to by anybody. There are some very, very funny sequences in the film, but ultimately it's a kind of sad film, and it's an indictment of drug enforcement and treating drug addiction as a legal rather than a medical issue. There's absolutely no attempt to medically treat people for addiction to substance D until after it's done the damage. And I think that's a point that comes very strongly through on this film, and it's a point that's quite important as well. The way that the war on drugs is waged in certain societies and in certain jurisdictions is exactly that. Until people are totally brain damaged, there's not a lot of medical support for them in some areas. And that's a point that's very strongly made, I think, by both Philip K. Dick in the original work and by Richard Linklater in this adaptation, that we've got to do more earlier about these things. And to tell that in a science fiction concept, I think this is a very underrated movie as science fiction as well. One of the great tropes in science fiction is, if this goes on, what will happen? And this movie takes that, if this goes on, what will happen approach to the war on drugs, rather than, what if machines become smarter? That's another one. What if our software becomes more sophisticated? You just heard some of my software there as my phone told me I had an email. I like this movie a lot. I don't think it's a movie I'm going to watch terribly much, but I think that it's a movie that is subtler than it appears to be, and that maybe that rotoscoping in some ways works against its success while illustrating the story itself and the kind of slippery grip on reality the characters have. All of that's evoked really well through the rotoscoping process, particularly things like the scramble suit and various hallucinations that occur. But I think for a lot of audiences, it may be a difficult hurdle for them to jump. But for me, I found it quite a touching film. I found it very right-headed about drug addiction and the problems with drug addiction and the problems with helping people who have that kind of a problem. While, I mean, yeah, we can laugh at the silliness of the Robert Downey Jr. character, and there's a sequence where a brake pedal goes wrong on the freeway and the car kind of careers out of control to a certain extent, which is quite funny. Having said that, it's the frame in which that funny sequence is put is quite a serious one. But yeah, I mean, this movie it was nominated for a few awards, but I don't think it's going to be on anyone's top list of science fiction movies. But I think it's worth revisiting. I mean, it's a 10-year-old film now that things are 2016, which still sounds crazily futuristic to me. And it really is Probably John Carter and this film match up as a good pair for the simple reason that the strength isn't in the main characters. The strength isn't in the like the front line actors in this film, the same way it isn't in John Carter. The strength is in the world that it creates and the world that it evokes. And I think that may be kind of the connection between these two films, even though I kind of retrofit the connections between the two films where I can, and they're not immediately obvious to me when I'm planning them. I think these two films are that the stars of these films are the worlds created, they're not the people on the screen necessarily. And both John Carter's very old and very dangerous Mars and Bob Arctor's crazily dangerous and out of control drug addicted Los Angeles are the stars of these two films. But anyway, that's about it this time around. It's time for me to edit this thing and then put it up and out there. Thank you for listening, and thank you for sticking around for 2016. This is the 9th year I've been podcasting regularly, and I'm looking forward to the 9th and the 10th years of doing that. Let me know what you think, cultguru@gmail.com. Drop me a MP3 if you like. Drop me an email. If you drop me an email, let me know on Facebook that you've done that, because my email inbox is crazily full of things I find interesting, but things that overwhelm some of the other stuff that I do want to see as well. And thank you to the people who support the podcast financially through Patreon. And as usual, they get themselves a movie-style credit at the end of the podcast. So anyway, I'm going to play the credits as usual, but in the meantime, keep watching the skies. Look after yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. If you're up north, stay warm. If you're down here, stay cool. And if you're in somewhere that's threatened by either floods and tempests or bushfires, as we are here, in fact, a lot of the coast, about 100 kilometres from here, there are over 100 houses burnt down over the Christmas New Year period because of a bushfire. So the climate, it is a changing. And look after yourselves. I'll be back very soon in another week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 2 weeks for another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'll see you later. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Second Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy the Donut Wrangler, Tim the New York Unit Director, and Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor. We also have Paul, who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen, who has yet to have a job in the credits. And Eric, of course, is the set security lead. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.